when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. It's podcast time. But before we get into the podcast, I want to tell you all to go listen to the first release on my record label that we, first time I signed somebody, a guy called DeBesque, who is a close homie of mine. The track is called Dale. So after this podcast, go check it out. It's an amazing record. Hope you dig it. So let's get to the podcast. And this week I've got the pleasure of speaking to the one and only Spencer Brown. Spencer is Bay Area born and bred artist, currently living in LA. He's creates beautiful progressive deep techno house music. It's really hard to explain what he does because it is very his sound doesn't change, but it does, and it's really special. He's released multiple albums and is in the process of starting his own record label. So I love this conversation. We had a really good chat, and I hope you enjoy it. So without further ado, Spencer Brown. Spencer Brown, what's cooking, man?
How's it going?
Good, man. Good to finally meet you. Yeah, good to finally meet you. It's I've been following your stuff for a while. And yeah, it's good to be in touch with you. So thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Really appreciate that. And you too.
Thanks, man. First thing I want to get out there is I was just doing some research on you, and holy crap, you've got a good name, like birth name.
Oh yeah. My legal name is Onofrio Spencer Jeffrey Bruno, and I'm actually the sixth. They skipped a generation, but I'm the sixth Onofrio Bruno, which is pretty nuts, isn't it?
That's mad. Where are you? Where does that come from? Or like where are you
That's
from?
Italian. Okay. Italian. But I'm fifth generation from California, from the Bay Area.
Okay.
So they moved from Italy to New York briefly, and then they moved to California for the gold rush, I believe. So okay. we've been in California for a while, but for some reason they thought it was a fun idea to pass on the name.
It's like the best name. I was like, how do you even pronounce this? My like English ass is just like, what the fuck? How do you even do it? I think Spencer Brown is the good choice for artist name, definitely.
Because... Yeah, it's I go by Spencer normally, so that was an obvious choice. And we wanted to change the artist name to not be my legal last name. So B-R-U-N sounded like Brown, and we're like, oh, okay.
Makes sense, man. Makes sense, totally. So you're in the Bay Area now?
I am in Los Angeles temporarily. Okay. I moved to LA during the pandemic, or actually a week before the pandemic.
Oh, really?
So it's a funny story, actually. I broke up with my ex, and I was kind of in a tough place. So I went down to LA to crash with one of my closest friends.
Yeah.
And then we got locked down, and then, you know, I'm in his guest room, and it's like 2 weeks later, we're like, should I leave? He's like, no, I don't want you to leave. It's like scary. I was like, okay, cool. Then like 2 months later, you know, I'm still crashing in his guest room. I'm like, should I just move here right now? So I just packed up my stuff and moved.
Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's incredible. Like, the Bay is home for me. I'll definitely be back. I think at the end of this lease, I'm going to move back to San Francisco. But it's been an amazing year and a half so far, and I'm going to do another year. So it's really nice. You know, I have a great studio, no neighbor problems, you know, really nice house, like beautiful weather. It's friends all over the place. It's great.
Yeah, whereabouts in LA are you?
I moved to Santa Monica. It's been an amazing, amazing time here. I have tons of friends really close to me, which I think is really important. During the pandemic, that was very, very important for me because I needed to have good company around instead of kind of being alone through the whole thing. So it was a great, great time. You know, everything's great. But I do miss San Francisco a lot because that's home. It inspires so much of my music. I'm not really as inspired by the kind of scenery here. I just find the Bay. I love the fog, and I love the clouds and stuff like that. Just like it being kind of gloomy makes me make better music rather than it being sunny. Cause I feel like when it's sunny, I just want to go outside the whole day and not work.
Yeah, I can relate to that massively. I live in Detroit at the moment, but from the UK. So in both cities, it's kind of gloomy, and it does just make you want to just work. But the minute the summer hits, it's like just too hot to do anything as well. And you're like, oh,
yeah, for sure. What brought you to Detroit out of curiosity?
I've always done, when I've done tours in the States, I've always like based myself in a city. So I just get like a short lease. So my first tour in the States years ago, I based myself in LA. I wasn't a huge fan of living in LA. As much as I love playing there, it just wasn't really for me. Then the next place was New York, which I love New York. It's like my favorite city in the world.
It's incredible.
Yeah. And then I needed something more permanent in America. And I didn't really want to pay New York prices because I wanted an apartment by myself, and I wanted to like have a bit more of a base. So randomly I was at Movement in Detroit, and I had some friends that were I was at a friend's parents' house here, and we were all having breakfast, and then one of our other friends who's a promoter in New York and Detroit, she was like, I just bought an apartment block in Detroit, like come and check it, come and like live in one of the apartments for like, I think it was like $500 a month, and like check out Detroit. And since then I ended up moving around Detroit a bit, and then ended up buying a place out here in just over four years ago.
Awesome, congrats, that's super sick.
So yeah, it's like, it's for me, Detroit is an interesting city. It's very poor, the history is very rich, and
for sure
it's a growing city that needs a lot of kind of TLC to kind of
for sure
make into a city that's a major city. I don't know if it will ever be a major city, but there's something about this that it's taken me a long time to actually like being here.
Right.
It's very backwards to what I'm used to in the UK.
Right.
But there's something really special about here as well. The community here is super interesting.
Do you find you're getting inspiration? I think that's the most important thing, I think, for me of living somewhere is that you can find inspiration around you, whether it's people or the settings. For me in San Francisco, as I said, it's the fog and the hills and all that stuff. That's where I take inspiration from up there. In LA, it's more the people, like my friends, my close friends, like being around, like interactions, coming home from tour, being around so much good love and good energy here, like that brings me a lot of inspiration here. But for you, do you find inspiration in Detroit?
For me, Detroit, I believe Detroit has probably changed my sound a little bit.
Right.
And that's not necessarily answering your question. Does it give me inspiration? Sometimes. I prefer writing in my studio back in the UK.
Right.
Because I still split my time between America and UK. But I think that's because I'm much more comfortable when I'm at home with kind of my studio there, and I'm like slowly getting used to this studio. But like all my hardware is back in the UK, and I think I'm a little bit more relaxed when I'm in the UK, where here it's like, here I'm in work mode. So I am pretty like productive when I'm in Detroit. I get a lot of stuff done, but I feel like the creative, you know, like when you're like writing, I don't know how you write, but when I'm writing ideas for a record, I find that they probably come a little bit easier in the UK.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. I think for me, the ideas come when I'm not in the studio, which is funny. Like I'm starting like 90% of my tracks just on my laptop and headphones, honestly. Yeah, most of the time I'm starting tracks in like a hotel or Airbnb or like a flight or train or something. Like I just feel so inspired when I'm touring around, and I'm really tired and stuff, you know, like that's where I start a lot of my music. It's almost really hard for me to come into the studio and like sit down. It's like, okay, I'm going to make a track now. You know, that's, it feels like too worky for me. It should be like a fun thing to make music. So I've learned recently that, let's rewind 5 years ago. Six years ago. Geez, I graduated from university and I was really trying to make music happen full time. So I was every single day, I would wake up at like 6 or 7 in the morning, make music until like 8 PM. I'd work like 15 hours a day on music every day. Even if I wasn't inspired, I would just sit there and just crank out music as much as possible. And I found that that's actually not the way to do it. Now that I'm grateful to live off my music and do this full time, but now that I have that kind of luxury and I'm honored for this, I only work when I feel like working now. And if I'm not working, amazing, go do other things, because the inspiration will be stronger if you don't force the music every single day, like sitting down the studio, treating it like work. For me, there will be a week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, random chunk where I write maybe 15 to 20 records that I'm really excited about, like no joke. And then there will be a month, 2 months, 3 months where I cannot write a single thing that I like.
I love that.
And that's just how it works. Yeah. Like, I don't know why, like it just happens like that. And like when I was in Hawaii, 2 months ago, I think I started four records in the week I was there, that I 100% am playing out, and I really, really enjoy the tracks. And then I leave Hawaii and then I'm like, oh, I can't write music anymore.
Hawaii is a pretty inspiring place. When I was there before the pandemic, I was like, I could probably do a month here of just hire, like get an Airbnb and just take some studio monitors and just like right, like looking out to the sea. There's something pretty
100%
special about that place.
100%. I think I was there. I was there with my family. I was supposed to be there 3 days.
Yeah.
And then my family leaves, and then I had one extra day because I was going to kind of write, and I felt so good with the writing. Then I got an Airbnb like for, I think, 2 or 3 extra days. And then after those 2 or 3 extra days, I felt so good in the zone, like making good music. I'm like, I'm doing another Airbnb for 2 days. So then I got another.
We're so lucky that we can do that, man. We're so
lucky.
I want to go back to when you left university and you were talking about that you went through the like the grind of writing music and you were kind of treating it as a job.
Mm-hmm.
How important was that part of your music production career, though?
I would say it really felt like the make or break moment for me, because I've been making music since I was a kid, like a little kid. I started my first recording, like me drumming and playing guitar and stuff, when I was maybe like 9 years old or 10 years old or something. So I've been making music my whole life as a passion, as a hobby. I got into dance music when I was like 13, maybe. I was like sneaking in the parties, and I like heard, it was like old dubstep at the time. And I heard like that OG dubstep stuff. I was like, what is this? I have to like get into that. So fast forward to answer your question, I finished university in 2016, and I had some, you know, momentum in my music career, but I couldn't live off it at the time. And I just realized, if I don't go for this full time right now, I'm never gonna make this a career, basically. Yeah. You know, like it hit that point where I'm like, I realized if I started looking for jobs and I started trying to kind of do music on the side while kind of doing jobs, I'm like, I'm not gonna make music a career if I go looking for jobs. So I told my family, give me 6 months to live at home, and I will either have a music career by then, or I will not have a music career by then. And then the 6 months turned into 9. I got to extend it 3 months because I was like, not quite there yet. And then nine months later, I moved to San Francisco, barely able to support myself, barely able to put food on the table.
Yeah.
But I was like opening a couple tours where you're making, you know, basically like $500 a gig, you know, like the super, super opening deals. And I was barely able to survive those first few months, maybe first year living on my own, until I released my first album. I think that was a major turning point. That was in 2018. So 2017 was quite a struggle.
Yeah.
But 2018, I released my first album called Illusion of Perfection.
Mm.
And then I think that was the moment that people really understood what I was doing. And then that, following that album, I released a track called Windows 95 on Acid on Mousetrap, which is my first kind of techno record that it actually hit number one.
Yeah.
And the more proggy album, and then the tech, and then the techno that everyone started playing it out.
Yeah.
I think that's when people really understood. It's like, okay, I get what he's trying to do. And then that's when bookings and headline gigs and stuff like that started to come in.
So, what did you do at university?
I studied electrical and computer engineering, and then comp sci as a minor.
Okay, so not really much to do with music as a major.
No, but the specialization I did is in signal processing. So I learned like the circuitry and the math behind EQs, like filters, compressors, what is a limiter, like all that kind of thing. I learned the like circuitry and the signal flow, and learning. I did a lot of work in acoustics as well, which was really fun. I did my thesis on I built an omnidirectional speaker, so like a speaker I built a speaker that radiate sound in all directions.
That's crazy.
So that was a really fun project. So I got a lot of intuitive knowledge about like engineering of the tracks and understanding how sound works on such a deep fundamental level. But I think it absolutely helped my productions, like subconsciously.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. That makes sense. I guess for me, what I was trying to get at it at the question is, everybody that I've spoken to at some point that's has a success in their in music or pretty much in any career is that there's a chunk of time where they have to work their fucking ass off.
Yes.
to like really get to where they want to get to, whether that's a year, 2 years, but it's like a year of just solid work and just like accepting that this next year, year and a half, 2 years is going to suck, but I have to get through this year to get to where I want to get to for the rest of my life.
Absolutely true. And I think about that, then that exact thing you just said, and I'm like, am I like lazy now that I'm not putting in that hard work, you know?
Well, I can relate to that as well, because I write a lot. And then during the pandemic, I wrote so much music. And when we came out of the pandemic, I kind of couldn't write a thing. And it was the first time in my life that I've ever not really been writing that much music. I was writing music for other people. I was doing a few other projects, but I wasn't doing Will Clark. Right. And I'm still at the point where I'm writing Will Clark stuff now, but it's still, I was writing like, I remember one, I had like 70 records that like were just all just like ready. They could have all been released, if you know what I mean. You're like,
right,
Jesus Christ, that's some serious work. But realistically, it's not. I think for me, coming back round to that is like, it gets to a point where I get a lot more picky and I want to kind of progress further rather than just writing club records.
Yeah, for sure. Also, I think when you write a mass quantity of music, like similarly in the pandemic, I wrote, I don't even want to put a number on it. There's so many freaking demos sitting on my computer that no one has heard before. Yeah. Dozens and dozens, maybe 100, maybe over 100.
Yeah.
That you get to just choose the kind of top couple tracks to release that are just the bombs, like the best of the best of the best. And then you could play the other ones in the sets and as IDs, and people may or may not know, you know, what the record is, and you don't even have to release it. And that's what I've realized, like, that those extra records that you've written that may not ever come out, that's not really wasted time, because if they work in your sets, they're just exclusive to your sets, and that makes people want to come out to your sets even more, because they know they're gonna be hearing music that they can't hear anywhere else. And I think that's a really important thing.
Like, I agree with that. How much of your sets is your own music, or how do you even like approach a set? Because I know you do your album thing and then you do your single thing. Like, how do you kind of break that up when it comes to touring? When you're like, say for instance, if you're touring an album, do you tour literally just playing the album music, or how do you do that?
It's always been, and it depends on the tour. I've done different things for different tours. There was one tour I did called the SBXID tour where I would play 3 hour sets minimum, and it was 100% my own music, and there was just mostly like IDs, a lot of my released music too, but I only focused on my own music, and that was really, really fun. I may bring that back because that was an awesome tour, but majority of the time, especially post pandemic, like growing up DJing, I started DJing in seventh or eighth grade, so that's like 12 or 13 years old, because I hated the music they played at like school dances and stuff, and I'm like, I could do that better, and that's why I started DJing. Back then, you know, when I'd be playing a 14 year old birthday party or something, you would have to DJ for like 6 hours, and no one cares who you are. You just need to keep people at the party. And I love that education, like learning how to DJ on the fly, like growing up and playing other music and digging for music that, you know, a balance of stuff that people know and people don't know. That I really missed, especially coming out of the pandemic. So the tour since the pandemic, I've been kind of, I organize a few different crates, like let's say a 3 hour set. I would organize like a lower energy crate, like more progressive, kind of deeper music. main kind of crate, which is kind of just like 126, just kind of mid-tempo, really good groovy, nice stuff. The high energy crate, which is like super banging stuff.
Yeah.
And then the tech crate, which is the percussive, like more techno, something. If the room needs to kind of go into a heads down kind of slamming mode, I would go into that crate and start playing out of that and work with that. So I usually prepare, and then a total crate, which is all the records all together.
Yeah.
And then sometimes one extra crate of like new tracks I really want to try out. That'll have like five tracks in it, just so I remember to play those tracks. And that's generally how I organize my sets. And then I just go with the flow. And it's, I would say usually it's two-thirds my own music and one-third music that I've found that I guarantee less than five people in the room would know. And then an occasional track that everyone would know that is a great throwback. I mean? But I try not to play, if something's in the charts and stuff and really like a hit that isn't mine, I do not play that track.
Yeah, I agree with that totally. I don't know why. Yeah,
because it keeps you unique. It's like anyone can look at the charts and just download the tracks. It just doesn't, I don't know. It's, I'm not trying to be like elitist or whatever. It's just like, it's way more fun to find some obscure record with 2000 plays that you're like, this is so sick, I want to share this with the world, than it is to find a track that you know everyone knows and then play it out. You know, it's just like the fun of DJing, the fun of record digging, you know?
Yeah, I think it's also, it actually turns our job into work. Like it makes, for me, it make like crate digging, I find it extremely hard at this moment in time to like find records that I'm really excited about outside of like my inner circle of crew, if you know what I mean. That
because
I find that, I don't know, I just don't think at this moment in time the quality of music is actually that great, and I don't think it's not out there, it's just hard to find.
So you bring up a great point. You said at this moment the quality of music, I would say most of the discoveries I'm talking about that I'd find are from 2009, 2013, just random tracks from even like 10, 15, 5 years ago that were just went way under the radar.
Yeah.
I would find that the majority of those tracks that I'm playing in my sets are actually tracks from the past that people probably don't know. You know what I mean? Because I do agree with you. When you're looking, what is the hottest new release? What is this? What is that?
Yeah.
It gets a little exhausting keeping up with that. So I don't really catch up with what's going on at the moment. I usually look in the past for inspiration.
Yeah, I agree. This week I had my tour started a couple of weeks ago, and we had like a couple of weekends postponed. And this week the tour starts again properly, and I know I need to go and spend like a day on Beatport and like Discogs and all of this, just to like find some new music of other people's music. Cause I'm like you, where I play most of my own music during my sets, but it's nice just to have a few other records just to kind of pepper in,
100%.
For my own sanity, really.
Yeah, 100%. Because it's fun at the end of the day. It's like, it's fun to play other people's music.
Yeah, I think that's the whole point, isn't it? Is what we're performing. We're not like rock bands where they have to play the same set every night. And we're lucky that we don't have to do that.
I think it's important to like, I want the crowd to come to the show and not have any clue
what's going
to
be played.
I mean, they'll hear one or two of the tracks that everyone wants to sing along to and stuff like that. But for you to walk up there, when I go to a show, at least if I'm going to see a DJ who I really like, I want to go up there and hear a bunch of stuff that I don't know. And especially, I think the big realization is that my favorite sets of my life had moments of, I can't believe they just played that, but I love it. I try to have a couple, I can't believe they just played that and I love it moments in the sets too. I think that's really important.
What's your go-to record that's that?
Ooh, I mean, it changes because you don't want to do the same moment.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the times I was ending my sets with this bootleg of Thriller, like Michael Jackson.
Okay.
That I made, like I was playing that out a lot. I think it's a bit played out now because I played it out so much, but it works so well.
Yeah.
It's like the last track of the set and then everyone hears Thriller and then it works really well. That's definitely one of them. I'm trying to think. I have a really good bootleg of, there's a track called Ludicrous Growing Pains. There's this really cool house mix of that track that doesn't have vocals. It's just the beat, and it sounds amazing. I think that sampled Bobby Brown. I don't know what the original sample was, but it sampled that. It's just little things that are that are like, is that Ludicrous right now? Or throw in some like Eminem acapella, like really filtered down that like is looping over some beat, and then people are like, is that Eminem or like, am I crazy? You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. I love stuff like that.
What's your thoughts on the current scene right now with kind of what a lot of what's really popular at the moment with the big, like the very common like samples that are being used? What's your thoughts on that?
I think, maybe in the past, like maybe years ago, I used to kind of like how, you know, I'm not talking about this specific form of music, but just any music that's like really popping. I'm like, why do people enjoy that? But now I'm totally like, well, that's for some people, you know, my music is for some people. So I don't really have an opinion. It's just like, I think overall, the more people get drawn into dance music on whatever scale, the more we all benefit from it, you know? So if someone who didn't really like dance music in the past is now drawn into the super commercial kind of music, the commercial side of dance music that's really popular right now, maybe, you know, they'll eventually get really into the scene and really want to hear a little bit more underground music eventually, you know, and some people will phase out of it, and that's okay too. So I think the music is not my cup of tea. That's really popular right now, which is, it's just not my taste, and that's totally okay. But it is some people's taste, and
totally.
Well, their taste may change.
It's majority of people's taste, isn't it? Because that's what's commercial. Right.
Yeah. 100%. But you know that some of those people will want something new, and maybe those people will kind of go in a different direction and eventually really enjoy something else, you know. And I think just overall, the more people who get into dance music, the better, because those people will either kind of filter out or get into different kinds of it. Because I think the pandemic really messed with our scene. I think there's a generation of kids, like the 18-year-olds, the 19-year-olds, who kind of missed the dance music during the pandemic. Like the people who are just first going to university, and maybe that's not their thing. Maybe they really like to watch movies or something and not go clubbing or whatever. So I think the more people we can get to be really into our scene, that the healthier it becomes.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the pandemic did kind of change a lot of the scene massively. And I think I think obviously we're still in it, which is very interesting, but it's definitely changed the crowd. It's changed how people go out. It's changed how people buy tickets. It's changed how people listen to music. It's changed everything.
It really has. It is crazy. I was just thinking about that, how different ticket sales, shows going on sale. The way people consume music, the crowds, it's funny. The crowds are either like when there's a big COVID surge, like the Omicron, for example, there's feels like a cautious energy in the air. And then when there's like no COVID in a certain city, everyone's like, like going crazy and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
If you can tell.
Yeah. I found it really interesting how promoters are as well. Promoters seem very, this is massively generalizing, but they seem extremely sensitive to anything that's going on. Which means that it kind of one bad thing happens and it's like, oh, the show's going to go to shit. Where it's like, hang on a minute, it's not. Like, let's sit back and remember that people still want to go out and party, and people still want to have a good time. And it's important that we still give that to people, because so many people have been deprived of that for the last 2 years, that they want to go out and they want to have fun.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the I feel like this is the reason I'm living, honestly, exactly, is to be a part of this scene. Yeah. Like, this is my heart. This is my love. And I know that other people feel the exact same way. So, like, even if some COVID or whatever, something is like damaging the ticket sales and the promoter's freaking out and everyone's freaking out, it's like, you still like got to show up and have a great time, you know, and play your gig. I know a lot of my friends, some shows and myself included, it's like, if we sell X amount of tickets and then there's some surge or whatever happening at the time, but we're still moving, there's like 50% or 60% of the people don't show up to the show. Yeah. You still got to get up there and show the people a good time. You know, it's just you can't be up there and be like, oh, like, people aren't showing up to the show because of this COVID surge, I'm not going to give it my all. You got to go up there and give it your all, because it's fun and people want a good time, as you said.
Well, I think that's the thing, is like, I don't know about you, but at some point in your career, you start worrying about ticket sales.
my agent and manager told me they don't give me ticket sales anymore because I was getting so worked up, and I have OCD. So like, I have a form of OCD that's very, very like mental, like uncertainty. And it would drive me nuts when I'm like, when they're like, okay, the show's at like 200 tickets and it's like a 800 cap room or something. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is going to be a nightmare. And then like 600 people show up at the doors the day after. And I was like freaking out over nothing. The show sells out or something, you know, like, so they're like, we are not giving you any ticket sales anymore. And anytime you ask, we're just going to hang up the phone.
Yeah. I'm exactly the same as that, but I still get ticket sales.
Oh, man.
It's like, I don't know what it is, but I can't even remember when I started worrying about ticket sales. Because it wasn't like, when I first started DJing, you didn't care. All you were cared about was going in and just playing records and making sure that everyone had fun.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess when it turns into a business, you're like, that's when you start. I think also, like, this whole, I try not to do it, if I'm honest, this whole thing on social media is like kind of bragging about selling out.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
I think it's really, for me, I really struggle with it when, like, if a show sold out and a promoter wants me to post that the show sold out, I'll put it in my stories. I will never talk about, oh, last night in this city we sold out, it was an absolutely amazing show. I would say last night in this city was an absolutely amazing show, thank you for coming out. But for me, the whole sold out thing actually means nothing to anybody else. And it's just purely an ego thing for me or my team.
And that's a really, really interesting point.
And I think it's like, everybody knows that you've sold out that was in that city, right? Like, because the club was fucking packed. Everyone can see that the club was packed. So why do we have to say it? And this is only my thing, because it just, I don't know why it annoys me when people do it. It's like DJs on private jets. It just annoys me so much. And I'm just like, you don't need to post about it. Like, fine, have your private jet, but you don't need to post about it. So shut the fuck up and just get to your show and do your work.
I know some DJs who fly private test gigs and don't say a word about it on social media. That's it. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, but regarding the sold out thing, I think it definitely comes down to ego for some, but I also think from a business perspective, it's like, the scarcity mentality of if this show sold out, and if you're trying to push sales for the next show, people are worrying, oh my God, the last one sold out, so I have to buy tickets. But I don't know how much that actually translates, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because I think realistically, if you're really famous, right? Let's just say you're Chris Lake, okay, at this moment in time, who, or like Fish or someone like that, who just sells out every single show. Like, your fans know that you have to buy tickets way far in advance before the show because they're going to sell out and you're going to miss out.
Right, right.
And I feel like that's something that as you get bigger as an artist, you get to kind of, your fans get to know your who you are and what your, not what your worth is, but how quickly they need to buy tickets because they want to do it. But a lot of people don't buy tickets until the night of.
Myself included. Yeah. If I'm going to go see someone and I want to go support, because I rarely will ask for list. I used to ask for list all the time of trying to get on the list. But if it's like, if it's someone I really want to see, I'll like buy a ticket to support. And I'll usually buy the ticket 4 hours before we go out to the club that night. If I have a night off, you know what I mean? Like that's, we're like, oh, do you want to go to this? I was like, yeah, for sure. Let's get tickets.
You know? I'm really interested in this actually, because you've mentioned this a couple of times that you like actually go out to see people DJ. Like I don't at all. Like I'll only go to a show if my friends are playing, but I wouldn't really go to a club to see someone DJ. I'd go to a live show, like a live music venue, right, to see like a band or something like that. But what do you like going to see DJs DJ?
Absolutely. Really? Like I go all the time when I'm off for a weekend. It's like, it was kind of a joke for a while, because I had like I think in the middle of my last tour, I had like 3 weeks off or something. I think I went out to see five shows, because I wouldn't just go out to go out. That's the thing. I go out to see someone who I really want to see perform. Yeah. And some of my favorites are like Guy J, for example. Mm. Like if Guy J is in my town or anywhere remotely near, I will be at the Guy J show if I'm off. Patrice Baumel, another one of my absolute favorites. Great guy too.
He's such a nice dude.
He's like the nicest person I've ever met. It's like a little bit scary how nice he is.
I met him in Austin randomly at a festival, and like he doesn't have a fucking clue who I am. Like, so we were just like talking, and all of a sudden he was just like started talking about crypto, and he's just like, it was just so random the conversation that we had. And then it was just like, and then we had to go and play our sets, but he was such a nice dude. Really nice.
He goes way, like I had some questions for him, and again, he didn't know who I was or anything. And I just like was like, hey, like, I don't even know, like if I just send him like a demo, and then he gives like a detailed paragraph with feedback, I'm like, what?
Yeah,
like,
I love that.
He did not need to do that. Yeah. You know? So that was, it's, he's just a really, really genuine guy. His presence also, like the energy he brings just when he's in a room is just, he's like guru energy. You know what I mean? Like teacher, healer energy. It's nuts. He's a great dude.
He's really fucking tall as well.
Yep. I want to circle back to close the conversation right before this of the selling out thing.
Okay.
The one point I wanted to make that I think is really important that my agent told me is, and I take this to heart, we get so concerned with numbers and sales and things like that. But at the end of the day, it's just a blessing to be able to play music to a crowd and to have people enjoy your music. Yeah. It doesn't matter. You can create a vibe in a room with 10 people. Mm-hmm. You can create a vibe in a room with 100 people. You can create a vibe in a room with 10,000 people.
Yeah.
As long it's at the end of the day, we are getting paid to play music for people. So it's like, if we don't sell out the gig or the sales aren't as good or something, that's okay. Just go up there and create a vibe for people, because it's a blessing to be able to play music for people in the first place. And that's the mindset I'm in right now with that kind of thing.
It's the best mindset to be in. And I think realistically, we all have bad shows. All of us.
Mm-hmm.
It's the biggest people.
Any artist who says they don't have a bad show is lying. Yeah. Like there's not an artist ever that has not had a bad show.
Yeah. It's, and I think being able to laugh about bad shows is the most powerful thing you can do as a person, because I remember I played a festival. I'm not going to mention its name, but it was literally the worst show ever for me. And I came off the decks questioning my career. And and I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, and it wasn't the fact that there wasn't people there, because there was people there, but it was like just the whole vibe of the festival and just everything about it. You know, just when you have those days, and probably part of it was me, like part of it was my, like where I was at mentally. But like then recently, like last year after the pandemic, I had one show that was just, the turnout was god awful. Okay.
Yeah.
Like embarrassingly god awful. but if you can come off the show and like look at the day, like I got to the city, I went to like a museum in the city. I went and had some amazing food. I like walked around. I had a really nice day. I caught up with one of my old friends, like, and then I played a show to a few people, not hundreds of people, but a few people that were there. Yeah. And they all had a great time. And realistically, although it was a little bit painful, I came off the decks and was like, you know what? Everyone has a bad day at work.
Absolutely. I 100% agree with you. Yeah. I similarly had one show since we started touring again that there was a mess up with the set times and this and that. And there were actually a lot of people there. And then everyone started to leave before I even came on. And then when I came on, I think there were like 15 maybe people in the club, like where we had sold like a ton of tickets. Everyone had left.
Yeah.
So it came on way too late. And then by the time I finished, there were three people and they were just my friends. So I just like played a private set to three of my friends, you know. But we all have days like that, you know.
Yeah, man.
Hopefully not a lot, not too much. But it's like you have an occasional, that's like one gig in however many dozens of gigs. Like, you know, it just happens.
It's, yeah.
It happens.
It does. But I guess the issue is that because it's our business, it's because it's our livelihood. I can only speak for myself, but I'm pretty sure you're very similar to me in this sense, is that it's like you want to better yourself. You want to kind of grow and you want to see growth in your career. And ticket sales is one way we measure the growth in our career.
Right. 100%. That's a really good point. Ticket sales and social media and the numbers,
and like
the numbers online. Yeah. And streams. But at the end of the day, it's like, does any of that actually matter if you are bringing happiness to people and playing great shows and you're changing people's lives with your music or your sets? Yeah. Does any of that actually matter? The answer is no, probably.
It doesn't. I think it's very naive for us to say that it doesn't matter, because I think it does to a certain extent, because
normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
You have
you
to
need a career.
You have to get somewhere, right? So, like,
yeah,
we're very like privileged in where we're sitting, where I know there's probably 10,000 people screaming at us going, yeah, but I fucking can't get a show, if you know what I mean. Right. And you're 100% right. Like
it does matter to some extent, yeah, I think. Like totally. It's like to take the numbers and all of that stuff and base your self-worth and your ego off that, I think that is where you get into trouble. Mm-hmm. I think if you can separate the business and the art, I think that's the best possible situation here. Like just kind of let your team figure out the numbers and all that stuff. And you just have a good time playing the gigs, making great music, you know, thinking of good visual components to your stuff, like stuff like that. Like that's
being the artist.
That's what matters. Yeah. That's what matters at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think, how do you interact with fans? Are you somebody that's like very hands-on with interacting with fans, or do you kind of take a back seat and just kind of stick to the artist and fan kind of thing?
So that's a really good point. I've thought about this a lot. There are times in my career where I'm heavily interactive. I'm responding quite a bit to a lot of people. Yeah. And then sometimes it feels really overwhelming because I'll look at the inbox or something and I'll have like 100 messages or something. Yeah. I'm like, wow, like I can't do this. And I don't want to be rude to these people.
Yeah.
But I just can't respond to any of this. What I did lately is I made a Discord where I kind of blasted out like, here's this, and I kind of like let it be.
Yeah.
So I have like a crew of really, really, really passionate fans and producers, and I'm really helping mentor some producers.
Cool.
Where I do feedback on their demos. They can submit demos to me and I'm giving everyone feedback and stuff. And I think by having like this nice little core community that really cares and I care about them, and that's been really, really nice. But I can't really, in a non-offensive way, it's just we don't have the time to respond to every single person who's I don't even read everything anymore. I used to read everything.
Yeah.
But it gets it's just a little bit overwhelming. It's not, you know, maybe if I'm in an airport or something, I'll like look at the DMs and answer a few people like, hey, thanks so much for coming out last night or something like that. But I the days are over that I read every single thing ever. You know, at the end of the day, it could come back to like kind of an ego thing, you know, like if you want your ego to feel like you're doing something good and you want to like read all this praise, and then you see the one negative comment and then feels like a dagger in your heart. And I'm like, why am I putting myself through this right now? Like where someone writes like, I think the set was horrible. it's stuff like, okay, dude, like
I love those comments. I used to hate them, but now I just play with people when it's like that. I'm just like, there's something about it that I'm just like, cool, man. Like, I'm sorry that you hated it, but I just respond like, I'll do better next time.
Yeah.
And just kind of like my view on when somebody, I've had it a couple of times and not often. I'm pretty sure like we're all in this community. We're all pretty lucky. I'm also very jealous of your Gatorade right now, by the way. Very jealous.
It's the best. I was just talking to my friend. Like, this is my like vice right here. I drank way too much Gatorade.
It's
anyway,
so
go
good.
On.
It's so good. Yeah. Cool blue. Only the cool blue one. All the others are shit. we have one in the UK called Powerade, which you get here occasionally, and it's slightly above par than Gatorade. But just putting it out there. What I find when somebody is commenting badly on you is generally reflecting on how their day's going and what's actually going on in their life. And I've probably said this on the podcast. I had one dude that would like always try and make witty comments on my comments and on my posts and pictures and stuff like that. And they're always like quite disrespectful, and I'm pretty thick skinned. Nothing really offends me at all. And I messaged this dude and was like, yo, I hear what you're saying, but just to let you know, if you do this to somebody else, you might really offend somebody. And
right.
And he was like, oh shit, I just wanted to be noticed. And I was like, I understand that, man, but there's other ways to kind of like be noticed. And there's other ways to you can do it in a nicer way. And ever since then, he never responded ever again badly. And
oh, interesting.
And I think like sometimes, like, I don't know about you, I've not kind of studied your socials, but like we have a manageable amount of followers. It's not like we have millions of followers where we can't keep up with everything, if you know what I mean, to a certain extent.
For sure.
So I think it's if somebody is commenting bad shit on your socials, I think it's actually like quite human to be like, dude, are you having a good day? Or like, what's going on for you? Because it's not, that's not a nice thing to do, if you know what I mean. And generally the response is like, I'm really sorry, I've just been having a really bad day, or like something, my cat's died or something like that. And it's always the case. Yeah. It's always the case.
I'll add on to that and say, when I was younger, when I was in my teen years, I was, you know, really struggling with myself because I was coming out at the time to myself. Like, I'm gay and I'm openly gay, and that's totally cool now. But like when I was a teenager, I was like a really, I wouldn't say disturbed, I was just like really kind of had a lot of like anger and stuff in my life. And I was such an internet troll back then. And I was doing the same thing, like trying to get noticed. I was like, I would look at things I sent on the internet when I was like a teenager, and I'm like, wow, like, what am I doing? Like, delete, delete, delete. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, some of that stuff I was writing, it's like, I can't believe I wrote that like back then. But that was just because I had so much internal, like, hatred and anger and stuff, like towards myself and the world and like all this stuff. And it's just like through maturity I learned to love myself and to love, spread as much love as possible around me, because that's the only way to do it. But I do agree with you. Like, when I was in a bad place in my life, I was definitely a huge troll online for people, like tormenting almost, like, and just like, what am I doing?
It's so fucked up what we do, like, when we're in shit moods, and like, we can all do it, right? Even if it's not online, even if it's just in our personal lives, it's like we can really just, like, if we're having a shit day, it can like bite back on somebody else's, on how somebody's messaged you. And it's like, we all take things the wrong way. And I think especially nowadays, the worst thing is none of us actually talk. It's all text. Yeah. It's all like short form conversation. This is one of the reasons why I started this podcast, because our paths would have probably crossed at some point, but unless we, even if we were in a club, we would never have had a conversation for an hour or two, if you know what I mean.
No, it's like, how are you, man? Where are you from?
Yeah, exactly. And like, have a great set. See you later.
Yeah, right.
And I think this is what we need more as technologies kind of evolving, and with social medias and just general communication is getting shorter and shorter. Like, our attention spans are so short nowadays. Like, we'll watch the same 15 seconds video over and over and over again because it's hilarious, because we want more of it. And then we just spend hours aimlessly scrolling, watching nothing. And yet we can't give our closest friends and family an hour to talk to a day. And I think it's just so important to keep long form conversations together. Because I think it also allows people to kind of feel comfortable and express themselves a little bit more and kind of hash out ideas. There might be some things that you don't agree with me, or I don't agree with you, and you can listen to each other's opinions, and then you can potentially change your opinion or argue your opinion, if that makes sense, which nowadays it just feels like everyone's just shouting at each other.
100%. It's like it's like, who can shout louder online? Yeah. Like, it's something I've learned, and that I'm actually in the process of learning. This is actually a conversation I had with Patrice Baumel, circling back to that. He was explaining equanimity to me, which is like the art of, like, not letting things affect you basically, and carry on that energy into the rest of your day or into other things. And as you said, it's like, if something bad happens, it's so important to just let it roll off you and just continue your day as if I'm really working on not letting, if something bad happens and I'm kind of feeling bad energy, not spreading that bad energy to my peers, to my roommates, to my parents, like to whomever I'm talking to that day. It's very important to just like accept that, okay, that's a difficult circumstance, and then just don't let that affect others around you. That's all we can do is be like an absorber of if something bad happens, you absorb the energy and then you just carry on with good energy to those around you. And that's something I'm really, really working on.
Yeah, I think it's really important that. How do you deal with, like, the industry that we're in is very different to everyday life, to what kind of a lot of people come across as in their what they do for their careers. How do you deal with the issues that come up in your career, and on top of personal issues? How do you kind of deal with that and manage that so it doesn't affect your life as much as it could do for some?
I guess it would depend on the issue, but it's something that I've had to work on. Like, we've all been in the position where we got 1 hour sleep, we feel miserable, we're at the airport, like it's crowded, like everyone's like sneezing on your neck and stuff, and I'm just like, I hate everything right now. Like I just but the thing that helps me the most is reminding myself what I'm doing, and that 13-year-old me is living my dream at the moment, you know, like that when I was 13 and DJing to a birthday party, I'm like, I want to do this for a job, you know, I want to DJ to clubs and to stuff like that. And that we're lucky then, we're blessed to like live this life. Like at the end of the day, the positives so outweigh the negatives that it's like, I just have to remind myself of the positives at all times. Like that is the way that I get over having kind of bad energy in the day. Cause I have been there. I've been in the airport and I'm like, my face is in my hands and I'm just like, I just hate everyone around me right now. And I'm just so like, I could snap it. Like if someone like pokes me, I would snap, you know, like it's just natural. It's human emotion, you know? But then I need to remind myself, you know, but tonight after this flight, after I get through all this, there's going to be a big room of people who really want to have a great time, and I'm going to give them a great time. You know what I mean? And you just, you know, it's just like a blessing to be able to play music for people at the end of the day.
No, totally. Do you know the one thing that gets me the most at airports? You know, this is literally the, like, I feel like this is like first world problems at its peak, but you know, when you're boarding the plane and the woman or the guy checking your boarding pass, and they're looking at your bag to see if it's going to fit in the overhead compartment and there's always that one person, I call them the fucking bag Nazis, because they literally there's always somebody, like maybe one out of 20 flights, that will make you put your bag in the bag measurer.
Yeah.
And it fits perfectly, but they're like, nah, sorry, it's too big, we're gonna have to check it. And I'm like, it fits. Like, what? That is the one thing that I turn into a grumpy old man about. Because it's just,
I know,
awful.
100% it's happened to me as well.
The last time it happened, my suitcase broke as well. The wheel fell off. And I was like, this is ridiculous. American Airlines.
Classic.
Yeah. Dude, we've just done an hour. We should probably wrap this up. But before we leave, what have you got planned for the rest of the year? I can't believe it's February. February the 1st today?
It's crazy. Yeah. Oh, wow. I have to pay my rent. Thanks for reminding me.
Sorry, man.
So, So in 11 days, I haven't really confirmed this on my socials yet. Actually, I probably shouldn't have said the exact date, but it's floating around. Like, people are aware that this is about to happen, but I'm starting my label. It's called Divine.
Congrats.
D-I-V-I-I-N-E. Thank you. It's there's become a point in my career with a lot of the music that I wrote over the pandemic that it doesn't, it's not that it doesn't fit anywhere. It just has its own thing going on. And I really, really wanted to own some of my masters and my publishing and like all that stuff. So for anyone who isn't aware, when you sign music to a record label, they actually own the track. You license your track, or they license the track. So say I sign an album, and I'm not calling any label out. It's just like, I sign my album. I don't get my album back. I don't own my album for 15 years after I sign that album. So it's like, you don't own your music at that point, you know, for 15 years. I really want to own some of my music, especially with blockchain stuff going on and crypto and like all this stuff that no one really knows in 5 years what's going to happen. I'm like, I want to own some of my music. Also, it's just fun to create your own brand of and your own label. Like, I've had such a good time. I've been working on this for 2 years. So we launched the label. The first release comes out in a little over a week. The B side of that first release. Oh, a third point. And possibly the most important point. I'm sick and tired of people, and I'm not calling out any label. It's just this is just the way the music industry is at the moment. People telling you that you make this beautiful track and they're like, okay, cool, great that you made this 9-minute track, but you need to make a 3-minute version for the streaming services. And I'm like, some tracks I do agree need a radio edit. Like, if it's a very radio friendly track, for sure make a radio edit, like, so it gets more publicity. But if I'm making a 9-minute progressive track that is just, it is what it is, and I spend so much love and care, I don't want to chop that down. I always say this, it's cutting your baby's arms and legs off. You know, like, you've created this beautiful child, and then all of a sudden you have to like cut it down. And that really, really, really bothered me. So the B side of my first release is called 18 Minute Loop. It's an 18 minute record that I'm putting out.
Is that just a massive fuck you to everybody?
Yeah, pretty much. It's like my creative FU to But the craziest thing to me is I was not expecting anyone to play this out. We sent out like the first round of promo or whatever. Surfaced a video of Digweed playing it out in Argentina to in Mendoza. I was freaking out because John Digweed's one of my like heroes. Like, I love John. He's another one. If he's in town, I'm gonna go party to his show. Go to a show with my friend. And to see him, who's one of my idols, playing out my track, that's truly a dream come true for me. And then the 18-minute track, he played 13 or 14 minutes of the 18-minute track.
That's solid, man. That's good going. That's really good going.
Thanks, man.
But, like, records have got shorter because of the streaming services. Like, even club records have gotten shorter. And it's weird because I remember, like, when I first started DJing, you'd have 9-minute records on a regular occasion, and now that's all like 5 minutes. It's weird,
but the feeling that I have is like, it's okay to make a 5-minute record. It's also okay to make a 9-minute record. It's like, the piece of art is the piece of art. Totally. Why are we changing our art because someone tells us we need to change our art? That is what I'm against. It's not the radio edits that I'm against. It's not the tracks are 5 minutes now. They used to be 9 or whatever. It's not the, like, it's the fact that someone else who is not the creator of the art is telling the artist how to make their art. And that's pretty much, I would say, the number one reason why I'm starting my own label, so I can put out music exactly how I want it to be, with exactly the visual component that I want it to have, with the artwork and the beautiful animations that we make, and with my own logo and like all that stuff. There's something freeing about that, because you have to play the game to some extent, but I am just, honestly, I don't really want to play the game with some of my releases. I want to put it out how I want to put it out.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you, and that's the reason why I started my label 2 years ago. It literally 2 years ago yesterday, we had our first release.
That's awesome.
And being able to have full creative control is
for sure
something super special. And I think it's something that with Web 3.0 and with the internet and with us being able to grow our communities and talk to our communities directly, I really think it's going to change the way the music industry is at this moment in time. And I can see a lot of streaming services, a lot of kind of middlemen in the industry having to change their business models because so many artists really don't give a fuck about them.
Yeah, 100%, man. I really think for any listener who isn't aware, like as an artist making dance music right now, that isn't commercial dance music, like that isn't like a pop mm-hmm. dance, like anything that isn't dance pop, anything that isn't dance pop, you can't live off your music.
No.
As like, if you're making club tracks, you, unless you are like the chart topping number ones constantly, you're not going to be living off your music.
Yeah.
You can only live off touring. Like most of our income is off gigs, mm-hmm. unless you're making, you know, chart topping number one hits. Your income's off touring. And that's kind of messed up because we don't really get paid properly from people listening to music.
But even to kind of counteract that with chart topping music, unless you're like Jay-Z or someone like that, where you have an amazing record deal, a lot of these artists that are doing big commercial hits, they're signed to major record labels that, and they own 18% of their fucking record. They don't even they don't even get 50%. And 18% of of a royalty deal where all of the marketing budget is recouped by the artist, everything's recouped by the artist. So realistically, out of it's obscene how little money people are getting through their music.
That's the beauty of Web3, blockchain, all of this kind of thing. I think this right now, it's such early days that it's kind of hard for people to get into it. A lot of people have no idea even about the technology. Yeah. I'm really into the technology personally.
Same.
But it could have the potential to properly pay artists because the whole middleman situation is gone. Like if someone can make a working business model that makes it convenient and cheap for consumers to listen to music with the whole catalog of all their favorite artists and everything super easy. And the only way for people to go to that business model is if it's cheaper for the consumer or more convenient for the consumer. Like no one will go out of their way. Or if the people who currently run the kind of industry, like the Apple Music, Spotify, stuff like that, if they change how they do it, which I just can't really see happening, honestly.
Well, I think the issue with Apple pay double to what everyone else pays, which is
Apple does pay double,
pretty amazing. But the fact is that not as many people use their platform, so it kind of doesn't even out, really. But realistically, like, I think the amazing thing about Web3. Is that it actually takes out the middleman. So
absolutely.
So I personally feel that there's not going to be another service like a streaming service like Spotify or Apple Music in Web3. I think it's going to be you directly go to your artist.
Yeah.
And I think, yes, you might be getting a lot smaller numbers, but you'll be earning a whole lot more money.
Yeah.
Because you're agreed. Actually in community. Like, I think this may sound a bit, and maybe it's not controversial, but like Patreon and OnlyFans, right? If you have a really strong following, you can earn a good amount of money
on... And then start posting shirtless pics.
Feet pics.
Yeah.
But like the difference between Patreon and OnlyFans and things like that is that, yes, they are technically a middleman, but they're not controlling who sees what. It is literally a platform where if I'm like, I want to go and, let's say, for instance, you were offering shirtless pictures on your Patreon, all right? And I was like, I want to see Spencer Brown with his top off, and I have to pay $9.99 a month to see that. I want to fucking spend my money to see that.
Right.
Whereas the issue with nowadays on social media, on all the streaming platforms, is Spencer Brown can release one record. You can talk about it on your Instagram and only 2-3% of people see that. And then you put it on your... It goes on your Spotify, it goes on your Apple Music, it goes on your Deezer, and you, let's say, for instance, you have 50,000 followers on there, and it only gets sent to 1% of those, and you don't get playlisted. You have this massive community of what looks like a lot of people, 100,000, 200,000 people all together collectively, but only 1%, 2% of those people are actually seeing it, which...
That's a really good point. I've never thought about it like that, but that's so true. It is so true.
Which is pointless. What's the point of having 80,000 followers on Instagram if 1%, 2%, 3% see it? So let's have 2,000 people on a Patreon or on OnlyFans or on whatever Web 3.0 that is for you, and build that community and give people proper value, like real...
Absolutely,
real value,
man. Like let's say back to, like, for me, Guy J, Patrice Baumel, like the people who I would go see, I would 100% pay.
Exactly.
Guy J actually has a Patreon that I do pay for. Yeah. He gives you samples and go to his Discord and stuff, and like I pay for that, and I think it's awesome, and I want to support him because his music has changed me, like, totally, as a human, as a producer, like, been to so many of his gigs because it means so much to me. Yeah. I'm like a big fan. Mm-hmm. Therefore, I would happily pay the $5 or whatever it is a month to be a part of his thing. You know what I mean? So I think it is important to that. That's a really good point, man. Really good point.
I think for me, my goal in my career is changed over the last 3 years. Well, it hasn't changed. It's been my goal for the last 3 years, and I'm still like in a working process on how to make it happen, because I haven't come up with the right solution to it, and that is to create as many super fans as possible. And I may... super fans is a horrible word. I hate using that word, but it's having somebody that really wants to be involved with you as an artist, and you as the artist is giving them value to their life. And
100%.
And it's all about a 50-50 relationship where it is give and take. And I think that's super healthy for artists to be able to have. And I think that we will start seeing very soon artists have a very small following, but a very kind of dedicated following.
And with the Web3 stuff, it's that is going to be the ultimate solution. It's just more people have to understand what it is and not think that it's some pyramid scheme or something like that. Like, people have to really adopt that for that to work. But I think over the coming years, I really could see it happening, you know, because this is the ultimate solution. To support your favorite artist, they should just be getting paid from the people who really deeply care about their stuff, who you've changed their lives. I think that's an amazing solution to the whole problem.
Yeah, because I think at this moment in time with the whole NFT stuff, there is a huge amount of just quick money, cash and grab. And there's a lot of artists, not just music at all, because there's only been very minimal people in music, but there's been a lot of artists that have been like, we can make a couple of million dollars and it's going to be very quick and we can do it and it's easy, which it is. But for me, what's important is the value side of it. There's a lot of art, there's a lot of people in music that, not a lot, but there's a handful of people that I've seen in at the NFT world that has created such hype, but not given any value to the people that buy into the NFTs. And it for me, that's quite demoralizing, because if somebody buys an NFT for Will Clark, I want that to go up in value for them. And I want that to be something that's very limited and very special to them, rather than a picture of something that's realistically not had any real art or time or love given into it. That's my personal opinion.
Yeah. Are you venturing into, have you done stuff in NFTs and crypto?
I'm in the process of working on a few projects. Yeah.
Awesome.
I've been spending a lot of time researching it, and I've bought NFTs and like looked into, I'll send you some stuff that I'm working on.
Okay, sick. Awesome. I love the space as well. I think it's a very misunderstood space. Totally. As you said, it's like, I believe if it's something that's really special, like for example, we're doing an NFT with the 18-minute track that I'm releasing called 18-minute loop. And as far as I know, it will be the first 18-minute or like the longest track ever minted. You know, it's normally like a 15-second animation or something, but we're like, no, we're going to make the animation 18 minutes of the whole track, like the intro and everything of the logo and the album art and all that stuff. And just mint the whole 18-minute bit and only do a one of one, just like one.
Yeah.
And that's like a special thing. It's not some BS like that I just threw together or whatever. It's like, I'm trying to do something a bit different and have some super fan who really enjoys that kind of thing. Like,
so how are you going to do that? How are you going to release that? Is that going to be like a bidding process, or is that going to be just a one buy now?
A bidding process, but it's going to start at zero or 0.0001, just basically like a cent, the equivalent of a cent, and just like put it on for a day or two and it's see what happens, I guess.
Dude, let me know when it happens. Let me know when you do it.
I'd love to. Hopefully be like a week after release, maybe of the EP.
Cool, man. Yeah, I'd love to help push it or get involved. So just let me know. And
thank you. I really appreciate that.
So what's your, just to recap, name of the label?
It's called Divine, D-I-V-I-I-N-E. So it's not like the word divine, but the divine is a very a great word for me, and it has multiple layers of meaning, which is why I'm so drawn to it. And it doesn't have to do with religion. In my opinion, you can kind of whatever religion you believe in, or no religion, that's totally okay. Like it doesn't have to do with religion, but it does have to do with more spirituality for me, of like gratitude, of just like of there is some force that's created everything that we know, and it doesn't have to be like a religious thing. Yeah. It's just like things exist and the world is beautiful, and it's like you want to just give thanks to just like for the beauty of the world, regardless of what you believe in. Like, everyone can agree that there's so much beautiful stuff out there. That's one. Number two, tying into my gay roots, it's like divine is a gay, it's a word in the gay culture that's used a lot, and I think that's a really an awesome like second, because I'm proud of myself now, you know, I'm proud of myself for coming out and like all of that kind of thing. So I wanted to play into that whole I wanted to play into that whole thing. And then three, I want just the music, like it should describe the music on the label. Like I want anything on the label, the music should be divine, like of the best possible quality. I'm not going to be signing music. It'll be mostly for myself and for my very close friends, honestly. I'm not going to be just kind of like signing releases that are like, oh, this is pretty cool. Like we'll throw it out there. Like I want every single release to be like something that it's a jaw dropping track where it's like a really, really, really top quality and keep the quality control, like do fewer releases and very high quality releases. Yeah. And that's kind of the reason I chose the name. But that was years in the making. I'm really, really, really excited. I think, and also it's like with the sound that I've kind of discovered that I'm kind of pushing, like this kind of ground between like progressive, it's pretty melodic. It's a little more up-tempo than the deep progressive. And it is like techno kind of all mashed into this thing. I don't really know if any kind of current labels fit exactly what I'm kind of trying to push. So I kind of want to make sure, like have that corner of whatever sound that this stuff that I'm making right now, I want to have my own kind of brand for that sound, because I don't really know, like some labels touch into that sound, but no one's really driving that sound. So
I think it's super important, man. And it's enjoy it, because it's very special when you start releasing music on your own label. It's definitely much nicer than releasing it on somebody else's label.
There's for sure, because it's yours start to finish,
and there's a lot more pressure. I don't know, for me there's a lot more pressure behind it, but it's so much nicer, man. So much nicer.
Yeah, but it's funny. We're like, I'm talking to my financial guy, and we're like looking at that. I'm just like, wow, starting the label's expensive here.
It's like expensive. Looking at all the,
but also you don't realize how much is behind the scenes when you sign a record at the label. They have like the PR people and designers, and all that's included. And now it's like all of a sudden you have to do everything on your own. You're just like, another bill.
But also, it's like you can earn more money as well, because nothing's split.
Right. You own everything. Except for the distributor who takes whatever, 15-20% depending on the deal. Like that you own 80-85% of the revenue now. That's so very different higher than 18%.
Yeah. Exactly, man. Exactly. How can people follow you? How can people follow the label? How can people do all of that?
Probably I'm on just the usual socials. Most of my socials are Spencer Brown Official. My Twitter is Spencer_Brown. Other than that, everything is Spencer Brown Official. And then the new label will be I don't think the website's set up at the moment, but in 10 days it will be set up, but it'll be Divine Rex, DIVINERECS will be all the social handles for Divine. I think the best way to communicate is through my Discord community, because as I said, I'm not really on the on the social media. It's
gone.
I'm not on it so much. It's just not really good for my mental health. But in Discord, I have an awesome community full of really cool, passionate people who love the music. And we all share music with each other, and I'm always popping on my Discord talking to people. So if you want to connect with me directly, the Discord is definitely the place to go. And I think there's an invite link on my website, spencerbrown.live. There should be a place to get in. If not, I'm trying to think. I think that's good. That's where the invite is.
Yeah, I think that's it. Sick, man. Well, I can put the Discord link in the description below. And anyone on here listening, hit the link below and you can get involved. Spencer, thank you so much for coming on, man. It's been an absolute pleasure. Loved it. And hopefully we can catch up next time I'm in town or we flit in between shows.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been an awesome interview. I love the interviews that flow. It's not just like drilling questions or whatever. This has been an awesome time talking to you, so thank you so much.
Big love, man. Keep safe, and I'll see you soon.
Take care.
Peace, man. And that is a wrap. Thanks to everybody that's listened. Go share it, hit subscribe, send it to your friends. Please keep sharing this podcast, it keeps it going. Keep safe. See you soon.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.